Report is a lie. They are still killing. They are planes 24 hours a day. They are martyrs and killings all the time. They are wounded and injuries. Children becoming orphaned. Innocent people. They haven't done anything. They were displaced from one place to another, looking for.
For more, we're joined at The Hague by Ahmed Aboufoul, senior legal research and advocacy officer at the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq. He was born and raised in Gaza. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's very important to have you with us today. The ruling of the International Court of Justice came down right after Democracy Now! Aired on Friday. So I'm wondering if you can start by summarizing the ruling and the significance of it, Ahmed.
Thank you for having me again, Amy. This is a very significant ruling. The court basically ruled that Israel must halt its military offensive on Rafah and any other acts that might endanger the Palestinian people as a group and their rights under the Genocide Convention. But the court also ruled that Israel must keep the Rafah crossing open and must allow all investigative bodies and commission of inquiries mandated by the UN to enter the territory and investigate alleged Genocide Convention violations and crimes and genocidal acts that may have been committed. And the court also ordered Israel to report to it after 1 month on its compliance with this order. It's worth noting that this is the third provisional measures order. In the first one, the court responded to South Africa's request by accepting some of the Africa requested. In the second one, the court also responded to South Africa's request by calling on Israel to ensure that humanitarian aid will enter the Gaza Strip from land crossings, including the Rafah crossings and other crossings, sending a very important signal to world leaders, especially in the West, that there is no alternative to allowing humanitarian aid by land, not the American PA or any other way, including airdrops. In this provisional measure, as I indicated, we can see the evolution of the court's, analysis of the situation and the gravity and the deterioration of the situation. So it's important also to note that for every provisional measures request, the court has to assess again whether the court can issue such order. So the fact that the court decided in three different occasions to issue such order, it means that this situation continue to deteriorate, and the Palestinian people as a group in the Gaza Strip are threatened in whole or in part by Israel's military operation, especially in Rafah.
And I wanted to ask you on Monday about the European response to the war in Gaza. On Monday, Spanish Foreign Minister José Manuel Álvarez said he's requesting 26 European Union member states to issue official support to the International Court of Justice and to take steps to ensure Israel respects its decisions. Your sense of the impact of how Europe is lining up on this issue?
Well, some European states, as you indicated, have been saying that this order is binding, must comply with it. Better late than never. This orders have been binding from the first provisional measure order, which some states, in my view, disgracefully tried to ignore or label as unhelpful. But we see also that in the West, in Europe in particular, some states are taking different position than that has been taking in relation to the situation in Palestine, including Spain, Ireland, including also recognizing Palestine, but also Belgium, Norway, and many others. So what we're witnessing now is the emergence of a different opinion in the European continent by states who are saying that this ruling must be complied with, including Germany. I think there was a statement by German officials that this order is binding. The question is, how the European Union will ensure that Israel complies with this order. As you and your viewers may already know, international law does not have an enforcement mechanism, and such order is worth what states make of it and how they utilize it to ensure compliance. So the question is, will the European Union and the individual European states continue, for example, their relations with Israel and business as usual, or will we see sanctions on Israel and other repercussions? Of course, it's long overdue for Western states to impose sanctions in Israel, severe diplomatic relations, stop importing Israeli settlements goods, stop exporting arms to the Israeli apartheid regime. Western states in general are complicit in these crimes, especially the U.S., to be honest. The Palestinian victims who are being shattered apart, especially in Rafah, like we saw in the targeting of tents in a designated safe area, were most probably targeted by American weapons.
I mean, this is key, what happened on Sunday. This was just 2 days after the ICJ ruling, talking about not having an enforcement mechanism. As you said, this was designated as a safe zone. There was so much international outcry as Israel bombed the tent camp, and it all went up in flames. Israel said it was because there was an oil tank next to it. But this is the nature of these concentrated population centers. A horrifying video went viral showing a man desperately holding up the charred corpse of a headless child amidst the still blazing flames of the attack, causing the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu calling it a tragic mistake, and he'll investigate. That's the response when there isn't an enforcement mechanism. You have Rashida Tlaib, the Palestinian American, only Palestinian American Congress member this weekend, demanding that President Biden lay out his red line, which he has talked about, but at this point has not seemed to say that Netanyahu has crossed it. Talk about the role, for example, of the UN Security Council and what it would mean if it took up the ICJ's ruling.
No, absolutely. You're making a very important point, Amy. And if you allow me just to remind your viewers of the fact that after every order of provisional measures by the ICJ, Israel has, in a way, responded such barbaric way targeting the Palestinians. Take, for example, the first provisional measures, which the court in which the court relied on UNRWA statements to assess what's going on the ground. Right after that order, Israel accused UNRWA of being involved in the October 7th attack. And several states, including the U.S., rushed to cut funding or suspend funding from UNRWA without even viewing any evidence of such allegations, parroting whatever Israel is saying, in fact lying. And then shortly after, as we know, they restored funding because they found out that Israel is lying. After the second order, which was focused on humanitarian aid and on the danger of famine that the court described as sitting in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli apartheid regime, immediately after this order, targeted seven workers of the World Center kitchen, killing nationals of several Western states, and claimed that it was a mistake, although the targeting was of several vehicles up from each other. And the reporting showed that such acts could not possibly be a mistake. After the third order, which is focused on Rafah and the fact that Israel has not provided the court of any convincing arguments or evidence that it has ensured the safe passage of civilians into those designated areas or the basic services needed for the survival of the population who would be moved to that area, the court ordered that Israel must halt its operation. Israel's response was to target civilians in a safe, allegedly designated safe area, and then claimed once again it's a mistake. So I think at this stage, one must not fool enough to entertain Israel's lies. Israel is lying. While we speak, Amy, just now I received the news that Israel has targeted another gathering of tents in Al-Mawasi area, west the Rafah government, where Israel also designated it as a safe area. The primary reporting indicates that over have been torn apart by this bombing. The primary reporting I received is horrific, like that of the targeting on tents that you just mentioned, and the horrific images that we've seen. So I think any allegation that Israel is doing this by mistake is just ridiculous. And at this stage, entertaining such allegations is just in service of Israel's monstrous and barbaric attacks against civilians. Let me also remind you, Amy, of the targeting of Al-Ahli Hospital, when Israel claimed that it wasn't an Israeli rocket. And then after that, we had several investigations, including from Western media outlets, showing that it is, in fact, an Israeli targeting. So what Israel is doing and what Israel was doing since targeting Al-Ahli Hospital is just sensing the pulse, how the international community will react to targeting civilians in a hospital. And unfortunately, the international community has not lived up to the responsibility, has allowed such monstrous acts. And then it continued. We saw how many hospitals have been targeted based on this lies. And this is a deliberate act, Amy, because it's with a genocidal destroy any safe spot needed for or essential to the survival of the civilian population. And hospitals would be on top of that list.
Ahmed, I wanted to ask you about a little about your personal story. You're a Palestinian Dutch international lawyer. You've dedicated your life to defending human rights, but you were born in Gaza and survived several Israeli assaults in Gaza. What is the situation with your own family there in Gaza today?
You know, this is, as you mentioned, a situation. It's a matter that is close to my heart. It's personal in many ways. Since the beginning of this genocide, as I mentioned previously on the show, I lost quite a big number of my family, over 80 members from both sides of the family, including my eldest uncle and many others. My family, part of my family, was, in fact, in those tents where they were targeted. We were lucky enough that only a few weeks ago I managed to get out, part of them out of the Gaza Strip, thanks to a funding campaign I launched, and I managed to get part of them to Egypt. But the rest of my family remains in Gaza, and now after Israel invaded the Palestinian side of the crossing, Palestinians don't have a chance either of leaving the Gaza Strip or even receiving the much needed humanitarian aid or medical teams that are much needed to enter the Gaza Strip. So the situation is horrific on every Palestinian. I wouldn't say that our suffering is the only thing. Palestinians across the occupied Gaza Strip have lost many loved ones. Gaza has been destroyed. Everything I know in Gaza has been destroyed, from my kindergarten to my school to my university, Al-Azhar University, and many other places which I have so many memories of friends, family, and loved ones in, have been destroyed. This is a genocide. This is about the erasure of the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip and as a whole. And this is the essence of Zionism as a settler colonial ideology that is premised on the elimination of the indigenous Palestinians to replace them in their land, supported by Western complicity in such atrocity crimes.
Ahmed Aboufoul, I want to thank you for being with us, and also condolences on the loss of 80 members of your family. Ahmed is senior legal research and advocacy officer at the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq. And just to be exact in my quoting of the Michigan Democratic Congress member Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian American in Congress, she posted on social social media, quote, "The whole world is taking action to stop the genocide of Palestinians, including the International Court of Justice. Where is President Biden's red line?" she asked. Next up, May is Asian American, Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. We'll remember the work of photographer Corky Lee. Stay with us. We're still here.
A letter to her kids was the last thing she wrote at a place on the Bronx where she lost all hope. She tried and tried to survive and provide for conditions she faced, but too much to take. Left her four children in the Philippines, to nanny in the States, and send her back dreams. Cause that's the way it works in poor countries where there is no work and you have to leave. For little pay, long hours, no job benefits. Fight if you tell it, just the hell of it. Abuse is what they call it, and so is slavery. To be a migrant worker is a display. I imagine a sacrifice, it brings me to tears, to not see your children for so many years. Finally belonged in our land of liberty, but some went wrong when they took her dignity. Even when the smoke is clear,
we belong by Tayona. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Month, the month of May. We spend the rest of the hour with the author of a new book that profiles the renowned photographer Corky Lee, who documented the lives and struggles of the Asian American community in his work over the span of half a century. Lee was recently profiled in a documentary called Dear Corky by the filmmaker Curtis Chin, which was featured on PBS American Masters. This is an excerpt that begins Corky describing some of his photographs.
This was from arguably the largest protest by Chinese Americans in New York City. There's like 20,000 that came out, and it had to do with an incident of police brutality. These two guys were in school together, and they were the tallest guys. And every time that the Chinese kids would get picked on and bullied, that they would stand up for them. But the key thing among all of this whole thing is this black kid right in the middle. And he's got this grin on his face or smile. And he just can't believe that Chinese are protesting police brutality, because that's something that happens in the black community and the Hispanic community all the time. This is from the 1982 when the union, ILGW, the International Lady Garment Workers Union, called for a strike in Columbus Park and 15,000 garment workers. This has to be the largest labor, you know, protest in Chinatown ever. And this is a candlelight vigil. This woman is lighting candles for a 9/11 vigil that takes place annually in Chatham Square. There are two streets that are named after Chinese who died. My photography connects me to people. You can be alone but not be lonely, I think. I started to sleep after my wife passed away. At the time, I had worked out something with the Museum of Chinese in the Americas back in 2001, and they wanted me to do an exhibit of my photography. So actually, when they heard that my wife was in hospice care, and particularly when she passed, they called me up and they asked me if they should postpone the exhibit, the solo exhibit. And I said, okay, fine. Let me go ahead. I went into the dark room and I did all my grieving, printing photographs in preparation for the exhibit. And it took me about 2 weeks. I came out, and still a lot of people who, you know, came to the wake, I mean to the opening, because it was probably a couple of weeks after the wake and the funeral, they didn't know. So you just sort of move on, because I think that's what my wife would want me to do.
The late Corky Lee, part of a documentary called Dear Corky by the filmmaker Curtis Chin, which was featured on PBS American Masters. For more on the great photographer, we're joined by Mei Nai, professor of Asian American Studies and professor of history at Columbia University, co-editor of the new book, Corky Lee's Asian America, 50 Years of Photographic Justice. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Nai. What a beautiful book, and not to mention life. Corky Lee died of COVID in 2021 at the age of 73, was born in 1947. Talk about what you mean by photographic justice and the breadth of Corky's life.
Well, first, thank you for having me, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here. Corky coined the term, I think, photographic justice to encapsulate what his life's mission was. He was a photographer, but he was an activist photographer, a social photographer, and he often said his aim in life was to break stereotypes of Asian Americans one photograph at a time. He wanted to make Asian Americans visible when we had been invisible, erased from American history. He wanted to show that we are real people with real concerns, and that we had a long struggle, a long history of struggle for social justice and racial equality.
And May, I wanted to ask you, this is really an epic book. When you first sent me a copy several months ago, I was really blown away because I had met Corky more than 50 years ago. And could you talk a little bit about his activist origins? Most people are not aware that there were revolutionary organizations of Asian Americans in this country back in the 60s and 70s, groups like Ewar Kuhn in New York and San Francisco, Yellow Seeds in Philadelphia, and Corky comes out of that experience?
Absolutely. I mean, that's where I first met Corky, was in Chinatown in the early 1970s. We were both young radicals making good trouble, you know, in the community. Corky was born in Queens, and he grew up in Queens, the son of immigrant parents who ran a hand laundry. He went to Queens College when there were very few Asian students there. And he goes to Chinatown in 1969 when he resisted the draft. He declared himself a conscientious objector. He opposed the Vietnam War. And he was sent to be a tenant organizer for a community organization in New York's Chinatown. And he started to take photographs of the bad conditions in the tenements. And then this was a time when the Asian American movement was bursting onto the scene. So Corky got swept up in all of that, like many of us did.
And in terms of when his involvement in photography, how did that come about? I mean, there was a basement collective of artists and photographers at the time.
Right. Corky joined a group called the Asian Media Collective, which was one of the founding groups of what became the Basement Workshop, which was an amazing arts center in Chinatown and in the budding Asian American movement. And he started out really taking slides. He wanted to use slideshows as a way of educating people, and that was a way of organizing people. And then increasingly, he took photographs of protests, of marches, of ordinary people going about their ordinary lives, all of this in pursuit of what he called photographic justice.
I wanted to quote Corky Lee himself, saying, "Every time I take my camera out of my bag, it's like drawing a sword to combat indifference, injustice, and discrimination, and trying to get rid of stereotypes." I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the portraits. Some, for example, if you can talk about the protests in opposition to the Vietnam War, demanding justice for Vincent Chin, the Chinese American man who was beaten to death in Michigan by two white auto workers in 1982.
Corky really captured all these moments, what we consider historically now is the key markers in Asian American movement, the movement for racial equality. When Vincent Chin was killed in Detroit, and then a year later when a judge handed down a ruling of a suspended sentence, he was convicted. They pled a plea of manslaughter, but the judge gave them a suspended sentence and $3,000 fine. They didn't spend a day in jail. Corky flew from New York to Detroit because he knew that this was a real seminal point in our history. And it galvanized what we might call the Asian American movement of the late 20th century.
Corky also often spoke about being a junior in high school and noticing that a photograph that commemorated the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869 did not show a single Asian worker, even though thousands of Chinese had worked on the building of the railroad. Could you talk about this?
Yeah, you know, Corky always told this story about his first encounter with the erasure of Chinese and Asian Americans from American history. Now, even if we know nothing about history, we Chinese know that we built the railroad, right? Even if we know nothing else, we know we built the railroad. And Corky was astounded when he saw this photograph taken in 1869 at the completion ceremony of the railroad, and there were no Chinese in the picture. So I think that became a real touchstone for him to correct the erasure of Asian Americans in American history. And so in 2014, he organized a mass showing of Asian Americans, including direct descendants of railroad workers, at Promontory Point in Utah. And that was his correction, right, to our erasure from the railroad history and history in general.
Corky Lee also photographed Asian delivery men picketing over wages at a Vietnamese restaurant in Greenwich Village, and Indians demonstrating against anti-Hindu violence in Jersey City. I want to turn to another clip from Dear Corky, the PBS program.
When people look at the photographs, they can sort of read into it that this is what was done during a certain period of time. If they see deplorable conditions, they can say this has to change. And maybe it'll motivate people to do something to enact those changes, either individually or collectively.
Well, were you in Chinatown when Muhammad Ali came?
No. The PS1 though.
You were at PS1?
The PS1.
1975. This is right after the thrill of Manila.
Before people started to come up to me and tell me that they liked the photograph, yeah, maybe I was, you know, somewhat invisible. But if I was invisible, I didn't want the larger community, Asian Pacific Americans, to be invisible.
After people see my photographs, they'll basically learn something about what it is to be Asian American. It's an attempt to educate people one photograph at a time.
And another clip from directed by Curtis Chin, the words of Corky Lee.
How much longer can I haul all the equipment and get the photographs? I could probably do this for another 15 years. I'll just keep going until I can't do it anymore. I may be 6 feet under pushing up daisies when people realize that I've had this tremendous visual record of what took place in the 70s, 80s, and the 90s. It's almost the history of Chinese in America. I'm okay with not being recognized at this point, because as long as the photographs are still around, posited, let's say, in the Library of Congress, researchers will start looking. At this stage of my life, I'm happy with it. I can leave something for future generations.
Yes, the words of Corky Lee, and we just have about 15 seconds. Professor Nye, you co-edited this book. What do you want people to take away from it?
Well, when we lost Corky to COVID, it was a tremendous loss for the community. You know,
he was filming Chinatown during COVID.
He did. And he always wore a mask, but that wasn't, you know, scenes. And so it was a great loss. But we hope this book will honor him and his legacy.
We have to leave it there. May Nye, co-editor of Corky Lee's Asian America, 50 Years of Photographic Justice.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CGSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.